legend in the house. So, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you for my next panel, the legendary Mr. Carl Potts. Big round of applause for crying out loud. Come on.
Thank you.
Now, Carl, you have become kind of a part-time resident of Maui, kind of. You like it here, don't you?
I certainly do. This is the second time visiting in less than a year.
Right. Yeah. Right? Get right up on it so we can hear you. There you go. There, perfect. Thank you, sir. Now, Carl, just in case anybody is here that doesn't know who you are, first of all, shame. But please, Carl, tell us what we should know you from.
Most people probably know me from my 13 years on Marvel's editorial staff, where I was executive editor and oversaw a third of their production. I also wrote and drew for the company when I should have been sleeping. And that included a run on Punisher War Journal. I created a series called Shadow Masters and another one with Louise Simonson called Spellbound. And I created for Marvel's creator-owned division a couple of titles, Last of the Dragons and the Alien Legion series, which ran there for about 9 years.
Now, that Punisher War Journal is a legendary run where everybody raves about that.
Thank you.
So that's the one I'm very most familiar with for sure.
And in 1988, a bunch of us who were working on the Punisher titles toured comic stores in Hawaii, including here in Maui.
Oh, wow.
And there's several people here that have come up to me that told me that they remember that event, and I think they were all about this tall then. They're much taller now, taller than me.
Now, I'm going to take you way back. I'm going to take you back when you were little Potts, all right? When did the notion get to your head that you wanted to work in this business?
I'd always been drawing, and I always loved comics, and I would, you know, occasionally try and draw comics, but
yeah.
The idea of actually trying to make up my profession probably didn't really hit me until maybe my first or second year in college. And I started attending local comic book conventions. I'd meet some comics pros who I was from the Bay Area, the Oakland-San Leandro area. And I'd meet people who actually made their living drawing comics. Holy
right.
cow, this is a real thing. And that included specifically Jim Starlin and Alan Weiss, along
wow.
with several others. And then I started meeting other would-be comic artists that lived in the Bay Area, including Steve Lealoa, Al Gordon, Frank Sirocco, Brent Anderson, Joe Chido. And I finally decided, I'd been managing a large record store. I don't know if anybody remembers what record stores are. But I was managing a large record store for a chain called Warehouse Records.
Ah.
And I quit that and decided I was going to move to New York and try and break into the comic book business. And Jim Starlin, who was one of the pros that had moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, asked me if I knew anybody in New York. And I was very naive, which is the nice word for ignorant.
Yeah,
and,
right.
I said, no, I just figured I'd go out there and see what happened. And on his own, Starlin called up a couple of his friends in the business that lived in Forest Hills, Queens, Walt Simonson and Al Milgram, who shared a large apartment out there, and said, if this kid comes out there, will you let him crash there while he gets his feet under him?
Right.
And they took his word I wasn't an axe murderer or something. And to this day, they're amongst my closest friends out there in the East Coast. And in the same building were living Bernie Wrightson and Howard Chaykin. So I was like just, I was starstruck and in awe for a long time living there.
What were you reading at the time that really like catapulted you to like say, this is, I'm moving and I've got to do this?
There were a lot of things going on, both in the mainstream and the start of what would be called ground level, which were not the, you know, the super raunchy underground stuff, but things like Star Reach Comics. Howard Chaykin was doing Cody Starbuck and things like that in there. On the mainstream stuff, I thought what Starlin was doing with Captain Marvel and Warlock were very interesting. There were just things here and there that caught my eye. There were a lot of black and white magazines back then. I love the Solomon Kane stories and the black and white magazines. So I liked just about everything, but my main big influence was from my childhood was the Steve Ditko created or co-created characters at Marvel, particularly Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. And so a lot of my style, particularly in the early sketch stage, you can still see a lot of Ditko influence there.
Right, right.
So I moved to New York, and I picked the worst possible time by accident to go, because that was the summer that Atlas Comics went belly up, and all the people that had started working at Atlas Comics were flooding back to Marvel and DC
right.
to try and get work. And but I'd also, a year and a half before, I had gone to my first San Diego Con. It was held at a motel by the airport. And
okay.
one of the guests there was Neil Adams. And I worked up the nerve to show Neil my portfolio, which was really bad, full of god-awful stuff. And he looked at it, paged through it, handed it back to me, and turned around. And as he turned around, he said, "It's not even good enough to comment on."
Oh, my gosh.
So I somehow found the nerve to ask him, "Well, can you at least tell me what to work on?" And he turned back around and named every aspect of drawing and composition and storytelling that there is. And then he finally said, "If you worked real hard for 18 months, I'd be willing to look at your work again." So when I got to New York, I called up Continuity Studios, where he and Dick Giordano ran an art studio in Midtown. And he said, "Come on by and show me your work." And they were just starting to package these black and white magazine-sized comics for Charlton, based on TV shows at the time, $6 Million Man, Emergency in Space, 1999.
Oh, wow.
And they were looking for young guys to come in and pencil those stories that under Neil's supervision, and then they would be inked by Dick Giordano and his assistants at the time, Terry Austin and Bob Wyachek.
Wow.
And other people that would kind of come through the studio were sort of, you know, "Hey, you know, we need to get these pages out. Can you hold a pen?" And that was sort of what they called crusty bunkers at the time. It was an ever-evolving group of freelancers that happened to be at the studio when work was needed to be done, and they get corralled into working on it.
When you finally got in, were they really working you hard on different comics at the time? Were you working on one, or?
Well, I started working on a $6 Million Man story right off the bat, but they couldn't have put any more pressure on me than I was putting on myself.
Oh,
I was just
golly.
Like, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God." I got it. The trouble is, too, is that there were a lot of likenesses involved of all these characters, and,
right.
and the production company had to approve them. And I've never been great with likenesses, and I was just sweating it. But thankfully, Dick Giordano was inking most of the large face shots and things like that, and he was able to adjust things. What we do, we start out doing these little tiny thumbnails,
yeah.
like 4 to a page of 8.5 by 11, and Neil Adams would go over them with his flare pen and strengthen the drawing, or sometimes he'd just totally ignore what was there and redraw something totally different on top of it. And then we'd put them in these large artograph machines, which are opaque projectors that would project down onto the large 11 by 17 artboard.
Right.
And we'd draw out the roughs there and then do the tight pencils, and then Neil would either approve them or ask for changes, and then those would go to Dick Giordano and the inkers. And by the time they got done, the pages looked great. It looked like I knew what I was doing.
Right.
So it was very good way to learn.
Now, working under Neil Adams, like you said, probably a lot of pressure. You know, he's.
I literally worked at the left hand of Neil for 3 years. I was at the desk next to him there.
When did he say, "Listen, kid, you're ready to move on to something bigger and better than the $6 Million Man and such"?
I don't know if he ever actually came out and said that, but I started working a lot. They did a lot of storyboard work for ad agencies, and I started getting into that, and that's actually where I was making most of my living. But comics being my first love, I always worked on those in the evenings and on weekends.
Mm.
But I could get paid as much for doing a single storyboard frame as I would for a full page of tight pencils on a comic.
Wow.
And the comic stuff, I was like always, oh my God, this has to be perfect. And it would take me days to do a page. But I could turn out, you know, a frame, a full large frame, pencil inked and colored in an hour. So, you know, it was kind of hard not to make your living doing that. Well, but it got a little boring. You know, how many times can you hold, you know, show someone holding up a carton of Minute Maid and smiling? And,
right. It makes sense.
So, but it did make me learn basic, straightforward, no-nonsense visual storytelling, because commercials, there can't be any ambiguity, anything that isn't clear.
Right.
So I was forced to learn straightforward storytelling without any gimmicks or surface flash cluttering things up, and I think that was a valuable experience.
Now, moving on to when you get to Marvel, and you're working on Marvel. What were you working on when you first got there?
Well, Starlin decided to come to New York around the same time I did for one of his occasional visits to set up his future projects.
Right.
And my second day in New York, he took me into the Marvel offices and introduced me to various editors, including Archie Goodwin. It's like, you know, meeting Moses or something. He liked one of my portfolio pieces and bought it for an ad. And then I went to a British reprint department where they would cut all the Marvel books in half for the weekly British books, and they'd need new splash pages for the second half of the story. And they'd often give those to the new people to try out.
Wow.
And I picked up a bunch of those to do, but I found out years later that the only reason I got those jobs is because the editor for those things took Starlin aside and said, I'll give this kid some work if you do a cover for me. And Starlin never told me, but he did that. I had to find out from Milgram years later that he did that. So Starlin's got all kinds of, you know, gold stars next to his name in my book.
Yeah. Now let's move on to one of your more iconic turns there, Punisher War Journal. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a little background on what inspired you for that? Because
well,
that was pretty...
I'd edited the original Punisher miniseries that Steve Grant and Mike Zeck had done, and John Beatty. And that came about strangely because apparently those guys had pitched it to a number of the other editors at Marvel and gotten no takers. No one seemed to feel that they would be successful. They didn't have superpowers. They weren't mutants, used real-world weaponry. But I always loved Zeck's work, and I liked the proposal Grant had sent in for it. So I went and convinced the editor-in-chief at the time that we should do this, and it turned out to be a huge hit. And then we started the ongoing Punisher series with Mike Baron writing and Klaus Janson on the art.
Yeah.
And that took off right away. And I kept coming up with ideas for Punisher stories, but I had no place to put them because Baron didn't need me to generate ideas for him. He was coming up with enough on his own. So I started thinking, you know, would the marketplace be interested in another Punisher title? And the difference being in the one I do, we delve more into his internal thought processes, where Baron's is pretty much all surface stuff. You had to deduce what he was thinking about by what he did externally.
Do you feel the way I feel that War Journals kind of defines the Punisher character? I mean, at least for me it did.
I hope so, but the Punisher is an interesting character because he's basically a two or maybe a two-and-a-half dimensional character. And that's easier to screw up than a true three-dimensional character. What would happen is when the Punisher got popular, all the other writers and editors wanted to start guest starring him, and so they'd have to come to me to get approvals.
Sure.
I'd get proposals for the wonkiest stuff. Like, they'd just say, oh, he's a guy that shoots criminals. So they'd say the easiest cop-out thing is, let's have him go nuts and start shooting jaywalkers and litterbugs. And it's like, You're missing the whole point. So, and other people thought that he was someone that, to be idolized and emulated, which was totally against what I wanted. I thought he should be a cautionary tale about what happens when you let vengeance take over your life and everything. And to do that, I tried to make sure in everything I wrote or edited that he never really solved any long-term problems. More often than not, he perpetuated ongoing cycles of violence. Anybody he got close to sooner or later, usually sooner, got killed because of their association with him. And he never got a feeling of satisfaction, even when he did take out a bunch of bad guys. Basically, I thought he was someone that had a death wish. He had great guilt over not protecting his kids and his wife when during that mob rubout.
Right.
And for surviving while not protecting them. So by taking on violent mobsters, he knew at some point he was going to be killed or maimed, which would make him pay the price he should have paid originally.
I always found that interesting because it always seemed as if, and you do it well in the war journals, like he's always looking for that. It almost felt like, I don't want to say satisfaction, but almost like closure to what every time he would do that. Like this was going to be.
And it never is.
And it never is. It never, ever is. So it's fascinating how you get into his head like that. And as a comic book reader, you're reading that and you're like, this is pretty intense. I mean, even for a comic book, it's like, it's really intense and it really, really thoughtful. I really enjoyed that very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Now, enough about Punisher War Journals. I have been specifically asked to do this interview with you to ask about one thing. All right?
Power pack.
And now... There's something that you're working
Rocket
on.
Raccoon.
Yeah. I've been told by someone who is, you know, pretty in the know. There's this little book that you're working on called Alien Legion. Is that correct, sir?
Well, I've been working on that for a long time.
Right.
And right now we're trying to deal with Hollywood to overcome some hurdles to try and get made into a film, but the origin of that goes way back before I broke into comics when I was trying to do samples to send off to the publishers to get work, and I had to come up with scenarios to draw. And I had two different stories I was doing simultaneously. One was about this group of human legionnaires in space in the future, and the other had a couple of different aliens in it, including this character that has a serpentine lower body. And one day, I accidentally knocked all the pages for both stories off my bed, and they all got mixed up, and as I'm starting to sort them out, the light bulb went on over my head, and I thought, this Legion shouldn't be humans, it should be all these different alien races.
Right.
And the leader should be this guy with the serpentine lower body. So that's an example of creativity is often just a matter of juxtaposing things in a new way that you haven't thought of before.
Now, I'm going to ask you more questions about that, but how does that work for you? Is it a process that happens like that when it just falls out into your lap, or does those moments of genius just strike you like that, or are you thinking about it a lot?
It can happen both ways. Sometimes it just comes out of the blue or it's an accident, but there are things you can do to promote that process. I'll often keep files, both physical and digital files, of articles and books that I like or interested in on different subjects,
sure.
Story ideas that have occurred to me, stuff that snippets of conversation that I've thought of or have overheard.
Right.
And then if I'm writing a story and I feel like there's not quite enough there, I'll go through these files and I'll take out a handful of these things that seem like they should go together. And try and see if I can juxtapose them in a way that makes sense.
Right.
Then I'll also take out one or two things that no way on God's green earth should this ever be associated with the story I did, and see if I can make that work too.
Right.
That initial Punisher Wolverine crossover, there's certain genre conventions that you have to observe, and most of those types of things, the characters, when they meet initially, they clash, and then eventually they end up having a common enemy that they go up against. So the idea from kind of a screenwriting background approach is to give the audience what they expect, but not the way they expect it. So that's what I try and do. And when I was working on that story idea for the Wolverine Punisher crossover, I was reading two books on Africa at the time. One was about this couple that was flying in a hot air balloon over the savannas looking for a rare form of cheetah called a king cheetah, which hadn't been seen alive for a long time. It's a little bit larger than your normal cheetah, has three stripes down the back and much bigger spots. For a long time, people thought that might be a leopard hybrid with a cheetah.
Right.
And there were skins of it in museums, but no one had seen a live one in a long time. And since big cats in the savannah don't have to worry about predators from on high, they hardly ever look up, so they can float over
here. Right, yeah.
And then I read another book about how the swamps in the Congo are the one spot on Earth where the climate has supposedly remained unchanged since the days of dinosaurs. And occasionally reports of a small sauropod come out of those areas. And occasionally scientific expeditions go in looking for it. And of course, they come tantalizingly close, but never quite, get the definitive proof they need. You know, someone forgets to take the lens cap off the shutter when they get the perfect shot and all this kind of stuff. So I created this story I did where the Punisher thinks he's been so active in New York and America that things are just too hot. He can't go anywhere or do anything, both the criminal world and law enforcement. So Microchip tells him he's got to get out of the country for a while. And one of Microchip's old college buddies is leading this expedition into the Congolese swamps to look for this dinosaur, and they need a security guy to go with them.
Right.
So he hooks Castle up with them. Meanwhile, Wolverine comes across this group of people who are poachers of rare pelts, of pelts of rare animals, including King Cheetah. And so they're both in Africa, and when they initially come together, each assumes that the other is doing the thing that they're up to go up against. And
right.
Then when they find out that they have the same goal, they end up teaming up together.
That's fascinating because, you know, getting back to the Punisher crossovers that you were doing, I always enjoyed those because it never felt like Castle belonged there. And that's what I really thought was really awesome about it, because it doesn't feel like he belongs with Spider-Man or he doesn't belong with the Wolverine.
It's always awkward.
It's super awkward. Yeah. And I really like that because it doesn't make any sense to him. That's what I like.
Did you ever see the ones where he appeared in Power Pack?
No.
Yeah, there's a couple of those that are very interesting.
And I liked it, but it was good. It made for a fun reading because it doesn't feel like he even belongs in this, and he feels that way.
Yeah.
And I really like that. I really enjoy that, and that's why I find him so fascinating. So when you're able to put characters in those situations, it makes it so satisfying for the reader. It makes it fun. It makes it interesting. It makes it exciting. So getting back to this exciting thing that you're working on now with Alien Legion, I mean, how far along are we before we actually get to see some of the fruits of your labor on this?
You mean on the film side?
Sure.
Well, this is how long it's taken so far. I wrote the first draft of the screenplay in 1995.
Wow.
And the property has been optioned a number of times by different studios. And for various reasons, like in Hollywood, like the person who bought it leaves the company and their successor doesn't want to deal with it and things like that.
Or, right.
Like it was going to be a TV series from MGM for a while, and then MGM decided they were getting out of the TV business.
Mm-hmm.
But a number of years ago, I optioned it to Bruckheimer and Disney. They'd had a lot of success with the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise of mixing live action with CGI characters.
Right.
And they wanted a science fiction equivalent. So a friend of mine who was a writer, producer, director, Boaz Yakini, directed Remember the Titans for...
Yes!
He was a big Alien Legion fan, and he goes, I got the perfect property for you. And so they optioned my screenplay and the property, and they proceeded to have half of Hollywood do rewrites for the next decade, including there are at least seven that I'm aware of, and three of them were done by David Benioff, the chief guy at Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones, yeah.
It turns out that I met him at one point. Turns out this made me feel old, but he said he grew up in Brooklyn, a huge Alien Legion fan. So between seasons of Game of Thrones, the busiest guy in Hollywood did 3 rewrites. And then Bruckheimer's people fired him.
No.
And they wouldn't let me read the scripts either. So another person that had been a huge Alien Legion fan for a long time was Tim Miller. And Tim...
Is he currently the director on Terminator Dark Fate?
But at that point, he had not had directed a feature film yet. But I'd introduced him to the Bruckheimer execs, and they didn't feel comfortable going with someone who hadn't, you know, even though he had his own 3D studio, was turning out amazing work.
Sure.
So right before my contract expired with Disney and Bruckheimer, Deadpool comes out.
Right, of course.
And now suddenly they're interested in working with Tim Miller. So they give Tim Miller the last David Benioff draft, and Miller read it and did not like it, and said he thought it sounded like they were directing Benioff to turn Alien Legion into a science fiction form of Game of Thrones. So in theory, I got the rights back because they didn't go into production within that decade. But there was this tiny clause. Disney's notorious for having these very onerous contracts with lots of fine print. And there was a clause in there that neither my agent or my lawyer ever thought would come into play, but of course it did. And that is that if the rights reverted back to me because they didn't go into production, I could make a deal elsewhere, but they could insist that deal include them being reimbursed for all of their development costs. Guess how much money they spent having... over 10 years having 7 rewrites done on my screenplay.
Okay, and now I'm curious, how much?
$6 million.
$6 million.
So even with Tim Miller attached, it's been a bit of a challenge to try and get a new deal set in place with that kind of extra financial burden attached to it.
Sure.
So we're still working on it. Hopefully we'll get it done.
Are you able to tweak your own creation?
Well, in theory, at the moment, I have total control over the property, with the exception of the $6 million, thing. But I'm a little reluctant to do much with it right now, because if we do make another deal, that company is going to want to have control over all the different licensing and merchandising rights and everything.
Sure.
So if I have too much stuff going on, it makes the deal less appealing.
Right. How close are we, do you think?
Oh, it's hard to say, because I've felt that we've been so close a couple of times, and then it turns out that,
Now, was this a screenplay in and of itself, or were you going to work on it as a comic series?
Well, I did do a new comic series a handful of years ago with Titan Comics called Uncivil War, but... The only rights I retained with the Disney deal at the time were the comic publishing rights. And with the way the market went, I retained the only rights that were guaranteed to lose me money if I exercised them.
Of course.
So I ended up inking the whole series because I was the best free inker I could find.
Unbelievable.
So it's a little hard to justify that expenditure at the moment right now, because I want to, get proven professionals working on it.
For sure.
So we'll see. The itch is always there.
Good, good. Yeah. Anything you're working on now that we should know about?
There's something very different that's been in the works for a while now that hopefully it won't be too much longer. It's a very large graphic novel I'm working on with Bill Reinhold that will be published by the Naval Institute Press, who started doing graphic novels now. It's called The Flying Column, and it's based somewhat on my family's experiences in the Philippines during World War II.
Wow.
MacArthur put together a rescue mission to rescue them from the prison camp that they'd been in for over 3 years held by the Japanese.
Absolutely. I'm very familiar. My sixth cousin is General Douglas MacArthur.
Really?
Yes, sir.
My grandfather, Henry Riley, was MacArthur's coach for a Shriner's entrance exam.
No kidding. Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, my that's where my origins are from. My father's origins are MacArthur's, so it's very fascinating. Super cool. So yeah. I wonder when you hopefully see that coming out.
I've been saying next year for the last 3 years, so But hopefully this time next year.
Now before we conclude here, what are we doing back here at Maui Comic Con 2019?
I'm sitting back there enjoying talking to a lot of folks that come by and visit.
Are you doing commissions back there as well?
I brought a bunch of art that I drew before I came here. I find it difficult often to draw at the convention because you're constantly interrupting things to talk to people and sign
sure.
And all that. So I try and do what I think people might be interested in before the convention.
Prince or your friend?
Yeah. Oh, I do have prints too, but there's original art. There's original art there as well. I know there's going to be people interested in things like the Punisher, so I usually do several of those. And
for sure.
And then I have Spider-Man and Venom and other characters I like.
Now, is there, in your canon of characters that you've done, is there one that you think is underappreciated?
Well, I really was pretty proud of the Shadow Masters miniseries, and it did pretty well at the time, but it wasn't like a super blockbuster. I have an idea for a new Punisher Shadow Masters miniseries that I pitched to them, and I'm not sure if they're going to go for it yet. There was a character I co-created with Louis Simonson, Spellbinder. This miniseries is called Spellbound, and I thought that was a lot of fun and had some charm to it. But Marvel decided, it was a six-issue series, Marvel decided that would be their first ever weekly comic book series release.
No.
And nobody was prepared for it. So, but by the time people were aware of it, it was over.
Right. And can we get a little bit of preview of that back at your table, by the way?
Yeah, I've got some Xeroxes of the Flying Column, which is the World War II thing that I'm working on, Bill Reinhold. He's doing the finished art in ink wash, and then we scan them and turn them into sepia tone, so it has a real
right
look to it.
Now, are you a social media guy? Can we find you on those social medias?
Yes and no. I have a Facebook page, but I'm in the process of trying to figure out how best to separate into my personal and professional.
Sure.
And I'm on Twitter, but I hardly ever use it.
I don't either. It's like everybody scrolling on a bathroom wall is what it feels like to me. Well, if anything, we can catch you at cons every year, I'm pretty sure, right?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Is there a professional page for your art and things of that nature?
There is on Facebook a page that's right now dedicated to my book, The DC Comics Guide to Creating Comics. And that might end up evolving into my professional page. I'll rename it. But I usually post things there about what I'm working on.
Fantastic. So for more information, make sure you say hi and talk to Carl Potts in the back of this very hall. He's way back there. I think he's sitting next to James Silvani, if I'm not mistaken. How's that guy? Is he okay?
He's all right.
He's all right.
Eric's there, too.
Good. Fantastic. So, ladies and gentlemen, please give a round of applause, big round of applause, for the legendary Carl Potts.
Thank you.
Make sure you go visit Carl, pick up a commission, or not even a commission, but check out some of his prints and original artwork back there. And Carl, thanks for coming, and thanks for being on Maui again. We love having you here.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you, man.